You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 91 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello!
Hello!
Wow! We have not that much to get to today.
No.
Look, there's not a lot of sports.
Whenever we say that, the podcast usually runs really long, so we'll try to avoid that.
We've got a lot of other stuff to get to that is not sports. But before then, I want to talk about this beer we're drinking. I have not had any of this yet, and I'm very excited to try it.
I was excited when I saw it in your refrigerator over the weekend. It's the Rubens Brews Bits and Bobs.
Our good friends at Rubens Brews, who we've never talked to.
IPA. An IPA with new hops every year. Every spring, it's not spring yet, but close enough, we create a new beer using a variety of hops at our disposal. These, quote, bits and bobs we have available, every year we have a new hop profile for the season. So
it's like an IPA blend, right?
Doesn't necessarily say what this year's are, though. That's I'm kind of surprised about.
Just imagine any hop and it's in there.
Okay. Is it going to have Simcoe?
Oh, of course. Definitely a Simcoe. That's one of the bobs.
I thought that was one of the bits.
This is one of the bits.
Oh, no.
this is like a red blend for beer, though, right? I mean, I think maybe a lot of beer blends into a lot of different hops, but they're just making us more aware of it.
I mean, it seems to me it's like, you know, the soup that you throw whatever you have left in, you know, the whatever vegetables you have left, or, you know, the leftover chicken, that sort of thing.
I got this, a toast to the fine people at the Brewmaster's Tap Room in Renton, Washington. We haven't talked about the tap room too often, but on Friday night, it's a brew house in Renton. They have a really good beer selection, typically. It's like, if you're familiar, it's like Chuck's, but it's in Renton.
A more local, small, slightly smaller scale version of Chuck's, yeah.
And they were hosting an event on Friday night for Renton Academy School, which is part of the Renton School District, for students with behavior issues. And I thought it was very cool that they were hosting that event. Mrs. Fantasy Genius used to work there at Renton Academy. So a fabulous Peltoncast shout up to the Brewmaster's Tap Room for hosting that event.
Oh, absolutely. And
having this beer.
Yeah, which is pretty good. Should we start off by revisiting a topic that we discussed last week?
Oh, God, no.
And that topic
is
the hashtag ALS Pepper Challenge. You'll recall that in a segment we recorded during last week's podcast, I called you out for the ALS Pepper Challenge. And you responded to that call earlier this evening before we recorded the podcast.
I haven't seen the video of this, but I'm curious to see how it looks.
It looks like you chewing a lot without making any facial expressions whatsoever.
I was trying to look completely unaffected by the pepper.
And yet, I mean, you did a really good job of pulling that look off.
Okay.
So
of being like I was just eating any food.
So we'll again post this on the page for the pod, as well as tweeting it from the Pelton Cast account. Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like the whole point of watching these videos is to see the moment when, like, oh, the quote, like people say, post the still with when the pepper hits.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have that moment at
all. There was no bass drop in this video.
Oh, no. It's the bad place.
You kept waiting for the drop.
This video was recorded in the bad place. But no, I mean, you know, I got to give you a lot of credit for just stepping up and taking it like a champ, especially after the misery you described in eating a preparational habanero a few weeks ago.
I think I was at a little bit of an advantage because I was already aware of what the sensation would be like.
Right.
But if you can't tell in the video, the people who I challenged, because my throat was burning with hot pepper. If you can't tell from the video, you just spilled all over yourself.
Not all over. Oh, okay. Just a little over.
I'm over here eating peppers, calling people out, drinking my beer normally.
Only after I reminded you that you had to call people out.
I was willing to just eat that pepper and then move on with my life.
You were done with it.
But the people that I challenged were, you know him well, at Guga31BB, Ben B., challenge to eat a hot pepper, and
I mean the original two Pelton brothers have both done it, so it only makes sense that the true third Pelton brother should do it.
It is true. I get the feeling that he also doesn't like peppers as much as you do.
It seems likely. Although he does eat a lot of Asian food, so maybe he's into it. Not that I don't.
And also, I think I said their name wrong on the video, but our good friends at Tasteful Profanely, a Beastpote production. Look, my mouth was full of hot pepper. There was was not coming up with almost anything else. My brain felt like it was going to explode. But both Mike B. and John Fraley have been challenged.
There you go. So I'm excited. I'm hoping that this spreads a little bit through Seahawks Twitter, because it is, of course, all for a great cause. As you mentioned on the video and we discussed last week, this started by my friend and former colleague Tom Haberstroh in honor of his mom, Patty, who was diagnosed with ALS last year. And donations encouraged to the ALS Therapy Development Institute at ALS.net. So while we're on the topic of eating, a more pleasant eating experience then a hot pepper is dumplings, and it's time for this week's matchup. All right, well, we turn our attention now to dumplings, and welcome in his third Pelton brother, someone who has been a member of our fantasy league and a loyal listener for a long time, and also has strong opinions, we've found out already, about dumplings. So we are thrilled to welcome to the program Aaron Zaz.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Aaron, we forgot to do this last week, but we should start out by asking you your dumpling credentials.
Dumpling credentials, that's a tough question. Well, first off, I'm not a small person. I definitely eat out way too much. I'll speak for myself. So I know food pretty well, but also I've been going to dim sum pretty much my entire life. Maybe once a month after church, my parents would take us there. So, you know, anything from humbao, barbecue pork buns, dumplings, asparagus, anything like that. I've grown up eating, so I know a good dumpling when I see one.
Had you ever been to the Dim Sum Factory, which was one of our two competitors this week?
No, this is my first time, and it's great to get back to Factoria. I love downtown Factoria. It's where I went to high school. I'd love to visit there anytime I can, but first time there.
Nice. We were thinking, of course, as I always do when I go to Factoria, of the classic Almost Live sketch pitting Factoria against the Bellevue Squares.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe that you went to high school in Factoria. When you're like, it's always great to go back to Factoria. It's like, oh yeah, of course. Huh? But you actually went to high school there?
Yeah, I went to Newport.
Wow.
Yeah, nice. Nights, I guess, whatever.
You were perfect to judge this round of dumplings.
Yes, yes. I knew exactly where to park.
Yes, dim sum history and Factoria history.
Really, really converging those two circles there in the Venn diagram.
Wow. So should we start out? This was Dim Sum Factory and Factoria versus Din Tai Fung, which is basically everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Not quite everywhere, but most everywhere. Let's start by talking about Din Tai Fung, I guess.
Should we?
I don't know. You think it's better to go with the upstart challenger?
I think we should start with Dim Sum Factory. Aaron, okay. I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Dim Sum Factory, it's great. It's more of a traditional Chinese restaurant that has, you know, it has the dim sum. I felt the ambiance was lacking, which I'm not going to judge with competition. We're not judging the, you know, the best looking restaurant in Seattle. We're judging the best dumpling in Seattle. So there wasn't a dim sum cart, which I like to see. You know, people going around, you can kind of see what you're going to buy. But overall, it was really good. I felt you got a really good bang for your buck at the Dim Sum Factory. For, you know, $10, you got about 8 or 9 or 10 dumplings, and they were, you know, there's a lot to them. Whereas Din Tai Fung, it's more of the suggestion of what you're eating rather than, you know, eating a big thing of shrimp.
We got dumplings not only for ourselves, but then for Mrs. Fantasy Genius to go at Dim Sum Factory. It costs only marginally more than lunch for the two of us at Din Tai Fung.
Yes. What did you get at Dim Sum Factory?
I got pretty much the same thing at both restaurants. I got shrimp dumplings. I got pork and shrimp chow mai. I got barbecue pork buns. I did not get a soup dumpling at Dim Sum Factory. I didn't see if they offered it. Did you guys get those?
So it was confusing. It required a lot of research on Yelp, but the reason they are in the soup dumpling bracket is because what they refer to as the juicy pork dumplings are in fact soup dumplings. So
okay.
That's what you kind of had to go with. And
okay.
I would say that my take is that those were the star of the show.
Mm-hmm.
That the other dumplings, a little bit disappointing to me.
Yeah, yeah. I felt at the end of the meal, I was having to kind of psych myself up to finish it. You know what I mean? I wasn't leaving wanting more. It was kind of an unwelcome guest, just kind of lingering, waiting for them to leave. Happy that they're there, but you probably don't want to invite them over again.
That was definitely the case with the shumai for us, I would say.
I think a couple of those didn't make it.
yeah. They got pretty tough. But again, there's a lot of bang for your buck. If you're really hungry and you have $12, I would go to Dim Sum Factory over Din Tai Fung.
And definitely not a big wait on a Sunday night when we went there.
No, even I was there Sunday at about noon, which I thought would be prime time for dim sum, and their status immediately. So that's a perk. Whereas Din Tai Fung can have their very historically long lines.
Exactly. I really did not like Dim Sum Factory. I mean, the soup dumplings. It was testing my hot take last week that all dumplings are better than all burgers.
That was a bad take.
The take might have been too hot, but this was one of the first times that I've had maybe kind of second-rate dumplings. And I thought the shrimp mm-hmm. dumplings in particular, I mean, like the pocket around the shrimp, really, it was kind of this weird gooey gelatinous substance.
Yeah. I'm curious, how did you like them to go? Or it sounds like Mrs. Fancy Genius had them to go at least.
She got the soup dumplings to go, and then also got like a beef soup. So I think those probably preserved better. And the soup dumplings were mm-hmm. close to what you would get at a Dozone Din Tai Fung. Not quite the same quality, but those still mm-hmm. were pretty good.
Yeah, I would say the soup dumplings were better than the ones at Mama's Dough. But that Mama's Dough still would rank much higher overall than Dim Sum Factory because of the fact that their pan-fried dumplings were so good.
The crazy thing to me was the buns. I don't. They were maybe shrimp and vegetable buns that we got, and they were supposed to be fried. It was not a good look all around. Dim Sum Factory is what it says it is. It's a factory. There's a lot of different things there. And like you mentioned, you can get anything you want at that place. But it kind of feels to me like a buffet. It's like you can get all sorts of different things you want, but there's nothing that it seemed like they did particularly well.
Exactly. Who is it on Simmons' podcast? Is it Lombardi would say, some quarterbacks have the small Italian restaurant menu of just a few things that do really well, and some quarterbacks are like Cheesecake Factory. They do tons of stuff, but nothing that well at all. That's exactly how I felt as well too.
And what did you think about Din Tai Fung? Had you been there before?
I've been a couple times. It had been a long time since I went without kids, which is great. It was night and day, to be honest with you guys. I want Din Tai Fung. They're across the world. They're a huge company. I want the little guy to win. But let's be honest. Din Tai Fung is far and away superior in just about every way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that sort of upstart local feel, that's going to come next round when we pair Dozone, presumably, against Din Tai Fung. I don't want to leap ahead and assume that Din Tai Fung
is after all this, we may be voting for Dim Sum Factory. You never know.
I mean, I was thinking a little bit about Din Tai Fung's place in this competition because, if we did things strictly the same way as we did in the search for Seattle's best burger, it would not qualify as a not just national, but in fact, global chain. But in this case, first off, because of the fact that there's just not the variety of dumpling locations that there are burger spots, and it inevitably qualifies. And then I think also because of the way that Din Tai Fung acted is sort of a gateway drug for other soup dumplings in particular, and maybe dumplings more generally in the Seattle area, in terms of stimulating, primary demand for not only wanting to go back to Din Tai Fung, but also to go and try other dumplings at other places.
Mm-hmm. I like the way you put it, gateway dumpling.
And it definitely was. We had the Dim Sum Factory late Sunday night, and then Monday morning had Din Tai Fung. And like you said, night and day. I mean, the difference in quality between those two dumplings.
It was literally night and day.
Din Tai Fung obviously is a pricier dumpling, but the quality is so much higher. I mean, you're willing to pay way more for what they're doing.
Sure. And it's so consistent operationally. It's really impressive. You walk in there, you see the people making the dumplings from scratch. You see their artistry. You see how skilled they are. You order it, and within 10 minutes, usually, maybe 15 if they're really busy, you have your food. It's exactly what you want. The soup dumplings are the perfect temperature. It just pops. It's just, it's everything you ever want in a dumpling and then some. And it's just, it's great. It's a great experience. You love it and you leave wanting more, which is something that I think is really important in a restaurant.
I don't know if I would say I left wanting more, but we had a lot.
We ate a lot of dumplings in 2 days.
Okay, I'll speak for myself then.
No, I completely understand what you're saying though. And well, at Din Tai Fung, I wanted to go through the order that we had.
Okay, so we had both the pork and the crab xiaolong bao soup dumplings. We also had shrimp steam dumplings, and those were pretty meh.
Yeah, I would not necessarily recommend those.
And then the wontons and spicy sauce.
Yes, the spicy wontons, on the other hand, I would recommend.
I think those are quite good. Then we had, again, the pork bun, which definitely not as good as dozo.
I mean...
No, I agree. I actually just had that a few hours ago at Dozone.
You went to Dozone?
You guys got me hooked. You told me it was gateway, Din Tai Fung's gateway drug. I think Mike Pence is going to actually outlaw dumplings pretty soon with how good they are, you guys. I'm hooked. My wife and I are hooked.
That's outstanding. We thought we had us going to four places in 6 days or 7 days was a lot, but you somehow managed to beat that with three consecutive days of dumplings.
Recreational dumplings. I'm very impressed.
Thanks, guys, but it's a problem.
So I'm just curious about your thoughts, because you went to these restaurants and you went to Din Tai Fung on Friday and Dozone on Monday.
Yeah, yeah.
What were your thoughts after going to each of those places pretty close together?
I would say Dozone, Din Tai Fung are just far and away in a different league. You know, it's like it's like Duke and North Carolina's playing, you know, an NAIA team. with just the presentation, the efficiency, this customer service, but then the most importantly, the food, the soup dumplings. It's just all around better.
So not to steal the thunder of our semifinal matchup, can we just go ahead and by acclamation advance Din Tai Fung here?
Fine by me.
So not to spoil that semifinal matchup between these two powers, do you have a winner of those two?
Wow. This is tough. I would have to go with Din Tai Fung. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
I'm very curious to see. Our plan is, I think, that week to somehow try to set it up so that we can go like same meal back to back, Din Tai Fung and Dozone. It is an audacious attempt, but it must be done for science.
I'm excited and a little bit terrified.
That sounds like you eating a habanero.
You guys should do it, and let us know how it goes.
No, we definitely will. Aaron, thank you so much for being on. Do you want to plug your Twitter account? But before then, wanted to mention that your band is headlining Barboza on Capitol Hill. Your band La Magistral is headlining Barboza on Wednesday, February 21st. Tickets are available now at thebarboza.com.
That's right. That's right. If you guys want to come out, we have a great lineup. We're headlining. Then we have great local bands, Moon Temple, kind of like a shoegazy kind of ambient rock. And then All the Real Girls. They remind me of kind of Conor Oberst, kind of poppy Conor Oberst, but really good. We actually played with them a couple times before.
But what type of music would you describe La Magistral as?
We're kind of alternative, twangy, folky, hard to say. If you want to check us out, we're on we have a Bandcamp page. We're not bad. You probably won't hate us.
All right.
Well, yeah, we definitely encourage everyone to check that out.
And where can we find you on Twitter, Aaron?
Oh, if you want to hear my garbage takes, at sawblade21, sawblade21. My pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
Thank you so much to Aaron for coming on. That was great. I'm very impressed that you went back to dumplings again after doing the Dim Sum Factory and the Din Tai Fung.
That's incredible.
Going in for the Dozone after.
And no, I mean, we ate some recreational burgers during the Search for Seattle's Best
Burger. I ate a lot of recreational
burgers. But at no point was it like, ate a second burger, and then the next day went for a recreational burger.
I think you're underestimating how many recreational burgers I had. You have burgers on the mind and you're just like, a burger would be good right now.
That is true.
I mean, like, look, if there were dumplings in front of me, I would eat the hell out of those dumplings.
I'm not disputing that. I'm just saying I wouldn't necessarily go looking for dumplings right now.
If tomorrow I had the opportunity to go to Dozone, you can bet that I would be at Dozone.
Yeah, I guess that's all true.
Anyway, my bone to pick, as always, is with you.
Oh, no.
Why was Dim Sum Factory even in the bracket? I'm speaking as the voice of the people here, right?
I mean, it was very convenient for us to get to.
Convenience? We are searching for the best dumplings in Seattle. Well, this is a bracket. You know, the NCAA tournament doesn't put in the 8 seed because it's convenient for them. They might. I don't know.
I mean, I think historically they often did do that.
They don't put it in because they're nearby. The travel costs would be lower. You know, they're going to get less flack for it. They're looking for the best competitor to be there.
I mean, if we're being truly honest here, we knew that either this or I think it was Ping's Dumpling House in the International District, which was the one that unfortunately got the boot in favor once we learned that Mama's Dough was a legitimate competitor, which it was, and certainly very deserving of its spot in the bracket.
And I likely will go back to.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was obviously the right call. And I was, you know, excited to go to Dim Sum Factory because of the fact that Factoria is relatively nearby. We couldn't have known that it was going to be as uncompetitive. And I still thought that the soup dumplings were good.
They're fine. Do we have Little Tings on the bracket?
We do have Little Tings in the bracket. We're going way up north.
All right. So Pelton Cast is going north.
It's unclear when we're going to do that.
Way up north for us is Greenwood.
I mean, I think most people think of Boulevard Park and certainly Renton is like way down south.
Way south.
So I think that's fair.
I was saying, like, we could have had a dumpling place that was in the ID and you replaced it for some place that, no offense to Aaron, that was in Factoria.
I mean, we also replaced it for a place that was in
Factoria.
Kent. And that was really good in Kent.
Fine. This should have never been, this was the 3 seed or the 4 seed. We just swapped out. We should have pushed them down.
Yeah, I mean, that's where the convenience argument came in.
Okay. As always, I have an issue with a bracket.
That's true. It wouldn't be a bracket if you didn't have an issue with it. Should we talk some sports?
All right.
As you referenced earlier, it's a pretty light week, but there are some things happening. We'll start with, at long last, an update on the Seattle Arena front. Last week, the Oakview Group presented to the Seattle Design Committee about their plans to renovate Key Arena and posted some new renderings that is shown on king5.com. Chris Daniels had that story. Highlight a few key changes, 4 of them specifically. Number one, a reduction of the atrium volume. There's an atrium outside the entrance on the south end of the renovated arena. The reduction of the atrium volume at the north and south ends to better emphasize the existing landmarked roofline. Also, a new entrance added at the center of the south side of the atrium to optimize customer flow. The southwest and southeast corners of the structure have been improved to allow better pedestrian access flow, and the south boundary along Thomas Street has been improved to emphasize a pedestrian experience. So, none of that really has much to do with watching
a game
there.
Design words.
Yeah.
You said the word atrium a lot.
But this is all part of the process. Okay. So we'll stay tuned.
This is the much less fun part of the process.
It really is.
Say the Sixers.
The Seattle Sounders. Last week was the MLS Super Draft held on Friday for the first 2 rounds in Philadelphia and then Sunday. And in the first round, the Sounders stayed local. They stayed at home. They stayed in the family. Drafting Seattle University midfielder Alex Roldan, the younger brother of Sounders star Christian. So this is pretty exciting. And, I mean, this is not a reach. Alex Roldan was expected to go in the first round in about this range, maybe even a little higher. He had 6 goals and a team-high 8 assists as a senior last year for Seattle University. He led the NCAA with 101 shot attempts, 49 of them on goal. I don't know if you necessarily want to lead the NCAA in shot attempts, but, you know, he was out there making things happen. He was in the mix.
I think you do want to lead the NCAA in shot attempts.
I mean, if you're also leading the league in goals, then you probably do. So we probably won't see much from Roldan this year. You know, I would expect, as was the case with Hanwala Buana, the homegrown player they signed out of UW a couple weeks ago. probably a lot of time with S2 this year, and you know, maybe figures in the long-term plans. Heard the scouting report is, you know, obviously plays midfield primarily, but may end up playing a little right back, similar to his brother has played that at times in his Sounders career.
Interesting.
In the second round, the Sounders drafted 6'5" Duke center back Marcus Fjortoft, whose father was a Norwegian international. And then in the third round, they drafted Villanova defender Chris Barrad, who is an outside back.
I assume you've been following their careers closely.
Oh, yeah, I've scouted them extensively, as one does.
How do their college stats translate to the MLS?
I'm sure someone has done that. That person is not me. The Sounders, having concluded the draft, began their training for the 2018 season Monday morning. It seems like just yesterday the season ended. And that's because it was only like a month ago. A month and a half, maybe, I guess.
They've had a nice offseason. They're older now. They look different. Many of them started to grow beards.
Could not complete doing so because it wasn't long enough. Roman Torres told reporters at MLS Media Day over the weekend that he's close to signing a new contract. It would has previously been reported by local Spanish language reporter Nico Moreno that Torres would extend his contract through 2020, keeping him in the Rave Green. And then another personnel move elsewhere in the MLS with some Sounders implications, or, you know, at least noteworthy from a Sounders perspective, Freddy Montero has left the Vancouver Whitecaps and is heading back to Portugal to play again for Sporting Lisbon there. So
that's a big move, right? That's not a small club that he's playing for.
No, I mean, and that's, you know, I think where he went after playing for the Sounders, and a pretty big move for Vancouver, which relied heavily on his offense last year as they gained the number one seed in the Western Conference. They end up number two. Yeah, I guess they ended up number two, the number two seed in the Western Conference before getting knocked off by the Sounders in the opening round. No, they ended up number three. The Sounders had home field in that series. I don't know. They were number one for a lot of the way, though. On the Mariners front, we will find out Wednesday. We are just, as we release this podcast, one day away from finding out about whether Edgar Martinez will be a Hall of Famer in 2018.
Man, it is close.
Yeah.
Have you done the research on how close this actually is?
I mean, not a lot seems to have changed since we last discussed this. Again, you know, Edgar's solidly over the 75% of votes that he needs on the publicly available ballots that have been tracked on the BBHOF tracker by Ryan Thibodeau. But when you account for the fact that the non-public votes tend, those voters tend to vote for fewer people.
Tend to hate Edgar Martinez.
Well, they want to keep it secret that they're not voting for as many people, so they don't post them publicly. I think he's probably going to fall short. But
wow.
My prediction is,
you don't think it's happening.
Edgar will be a Hall of Famer in 2019.
Really?
So one of the things I wanted to look at, dating back to when we previously discussed this on the podcast, is
agreed on this a couple weeks ago.
How the ballot is going to change next year. So this year you have a couple of first-timers that are almost certainly going to get in Chipper Jones and Jim Tome, as well as Vlad Guerrero, who was the leading vote-getter among the returning players. So that clears three players off the ballots that are competing with Edgar Martinez for votes. And then if you look at the players who are going to be eligible in 2018, who are first-time Hall of Famers retired after the 2013 season, Mariano Rivera will probably get close to 100% of the vote, unless there's someone who's like, I'm not voting for any relief pitcher under any circumstance.
There has to be that person, right?
Okay, he might not be unanimous. He's getting it as a first ballot Hall of Famer.
Because relief pitchers are nowhere near as valuable as almost any other player, right?
I mean, if you look at leverage, stats like win probability added, the relievers, closers, and star relievers end up really high in those ratings. They don't fare quite as well by WAR, but Rivera's still obviously far and away number, or not far and away, because also on the ballot next year we have a couple of longtime starting pitchers, Roy Halladay and Andy Pettit, and then also Todd Helton will be the top hitter on the ballot. But I don't see any of those players as likely first ballot Hall of Famers. I think Rivera is the only one who's going to command a big share of the vote.
Rivera's definitely making it.
Yeah, oh yeah. I mean, there's no question about that. Again, it's just, you know, will it be easier or harder to get votes for Edgar Martinez? And I think it'll pretty clearly be easier.
I just searched for Edgar McNabb on Baseball Reference. It's a comparison. He's very old.
Is he going to make the Hall of Fame?
He would have in like 1910.
Oh, no. All right, continue.
I just want to see to compare how many wins Mariano Rivera is. Was worth for his career versus Edgar. per Baseball Reference, Edgar Martinez worth about 68 wins for his career. Mariano Rivera, 56 wins for his career. But as you said, you know, that stat tends to be skewed toward position players and starting pitchers.
Yeah, which also, when I actually went to go double check this, both the late Roy Halladay and Addie Pettit did have more career war than Rivera. But, you know, again, when you look at the win probability added, Rivera is going to come out very high. Continuing our roundup, should we talk quickly about Husky football? Last Saturday, six Husky recruits played in the Polynesian Bowl in Honolulu, and the standout among those, cornerback Kyler Gordon, who was named defensive MVP of that game after scoring on a pick six and forcing a fumble.
God, this defense is going to be good.
We haven't talked. I don't think this came up when we were talking about recruiting.
You scout the Polynesian Bowl, though, right?
Well,
I mean, you're not doing translations from college soccer to the MLS, but you definitely look at Polynesian Bowl stats.
I must confess that I don't, but friend of the pod, Seth Colin, recently moved from Seattle to Honolulu.
Really? Congrats.
My fellow SSSBDA member. And he was there in full effect checking this game out and checking out these UW recruits. But we haven't talked about, I don't think we talked when we talked about the UW recruiting class about the fact, well, because Kyler Gordon hadn't signed at that point, about the fact that he was a member of the Storm dance troupe for five seasons.
Oh, that was Kyler Gordon?
Yes.
So we saw him dancing as a child.
Yes. I mean, like, he was like a notable member of the Storm dance troupe. And his claim to fame, I would say, in this role, in 2010, during the season the Storm ended up winning a championship, he did a video for one of the timeout features with then head coach Brian Agler, where he asked Brian Agler, first off, Brian Agler asked him what he wanted to do when he grew up. And Kyler said he was unclear whether he wanted to play football or basketball, that he probably had to decide between the two. And it looks like he's chosen football. But he asks Brian Agler his favorite dance move, and Agler just gives him like kind of a little leg shake, and Kyler says, "Oh, the steaky leg?
This was that kid?
This was that kid.
Kyler Gordon?
Yeah. This is amazing. I went and watched the whole video today." And that became a sensation to the point where, partially because of my encouragement, Brian Agler ended up doing the steaky leg at the championship celebration after the Storm won the title in 2010. Wow. So there you go, with Kyler Gordon, integral member of Storm history, and hopefully soon, integral member of Husky football history. Well, while we're here, we'll talk quickly about UW.
You do want to mention this, but Brandon Cahill, linebacker who committed to UW, you felt like this does not matter at all. But per 247 Sports, which is kind of like the new scout, right? They had moved Brandon Cahill, middle linebacker commit, to UW, flip from BYU, kind of late in the process, choosing UW over schools like Alabama. In their final rankings, was moved up to be a five-star recruit, making him the first five-star recruit of Coach Pete's career.
So did Brandon Cahill, like, did he have a great game last week? Did he, like, all of a sudden get faster or stronger? Like, no, I mean, he's the same player he was this week as last week. He's a good prospect without question.
More information about him.
He also
was playing at the Polynesian Bowl. And
it is true.
Steve Wolfong, director of recruiting for 247 Sports, says he's the most athletic linebacker in the country.
Well, that is exciting. I can get behind that. I just think that the difference between what's a four-star recruit and what's a five-star recruit is pretty arbitrary.
I mean, he's going to be good. This defense is going to be so good. We talked about this for years and years and years. What could Coach Pete do when he has the recruiting prowess of UW? And it's really finally starting to happen.
Yeah, it turns out that he actually is still going to be able to identify good players and just get even more of them. So that's good. I'm glad the Huskies have Coach Pete. While we're here, UW women's basketball, we mentioned last week, was the Women's Basketball Apple Cup. Both games get played in the same week. The Huskies lost in overtime 78-75 in Pullman on Wednesday. Had a chance to win that at the end of regulation, but Amber Melgoza split two free throws, sending it to OT, where the Huskies lost. But they were able to avenge and even the series on Sunday at home against Wazoo, getting their first conference win by a 56-49 final. This weekend, the UW women will host UCLA and USC. UCLA comes in tied for second in the Pac-12 at 6-2, but USC just 3-5 so far in Pac-12 play. Should be an opportunity, I think, for the Huskies to maybe get a second conference win. We'll conclude our roundup, I guess, with the Seahawks, where more news on the coaching front from the Seahawks this week. On Monday, they, quote, mutually parted ways with senior defensive assistant Travis Jones. And I'm still not sure exactly what mutually parted ways entails.
That means he was fired.
I mean, It's possible that there could be some desire for a different role or a change of scenery, but just the mutual, it's like the only way I imagine it is like 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, like both of us say what we're thinking. I want to leave. I want to get rid of you. Like that's the only way it can truly ever be mutual. Get it? Right? Yes.
If the Seahawks are doing that in their front office, the other thing is that I have never heard of this person.
That's the thing about the Seahawks coaching staff is there's a lot of people on the Seahawks coaching staff. Can you name the people? So Travis Jones, until last year, had been the defensive line coach since 2013 when he came in with
Chris Richard?
Dan Quinn.
Oh.
I don't know why I couldn't think of that for a second. Do you know who are currently the co-defensive line coaches for the Seahawks? Well, you probably do because you're looking at it now on the note.
Clint Hurt?
Clint Hurt and Dwayne Board.
Dwayne Board. I didn't know if Dwayne Board was a name or
or like a position.
He's on the Dwayne Board.
Oh, no. That's like a mock draft thing. Dwayne Board's draft board. I think that could be a second career for him.
Dwayne Board's draft board.
So there were a lot of rumors this week about the Seahawks quarterback coach position. Where you'll recall that veteran Carl Smith had been reported previously that he might be out as quarterback coach. Bob Condotta, the Seattle Times, had consistently reported that he would remain on the staff in some capacity. So there was a lot of rumors about Jim Zorn potentially being his replacement. Of course, the Seahawks legendary quarterback who was the team's quarterback coach from 2001 through 2007 before inexplicably being named the head coach of the Washington professional football team with no experience whatsoever as a coordinator. But now it appears the Seahawks are going in a different direction, as Alex Marvez of Sporting News reported Monday that the Seahawks will name their wide receiver coach Dave Canales their quarterback coach. This would be a bit of a surprise given that Canales was a wide receiver in college and has never coached quarterbacks.
Just wait for a lot of wide receiver passing plays.
But maybe more to this story is still developing is...
Russ is going to be catching touchdowns next year.
Hey, I mean, he's already caught one of them. He looked very good doing so. Doug Baldwin maybe will throw the passes. Condotta reported that later that this move has not happened, but could happen. So we will stay tuned, of course, on the Seahawks quarterback coach front.
Yes, extensive coverage.
Round-the-clock coverage.
Also, any move could happen.
I mean, I suppose that is true. It's really more of an existential thing that Bob Condotta is pointing out here. The other move involving Seahawks coaches that happened this week is first reported by G. Scott of ESPN 710. The Cowboys have hired Chris Richard as their defensive back coach and passing game coordinator, Lou landing spot for the deposed former Seahawks defensive coordinator.
Can we pour one out for Chris Richard? Yeah, I still feel like Chris Richard didn't necessarily get a fair shake here.
I mean, Pete Carroll knows a lot more than we did about what was going on internally, but it was definitely surprising. And
turns out it was every other coach's fault but his.
Oh no, not every other coach. not Dwayne Board's fault.
Dwayne Board was doing his job.
Yeah. By the way, is it amazing that out of this all this, we've heard nothing about Brian Schneider, the special teams coordinator?
And you mean how bad the special teams was?
How not great the special teams was. Not at the level I think that Pete Carroll would like it to be at, but he has not been involved in this whatsoever. Anyways,
he rates highly on Dwayne Board's staff board.
He's got all sorts of boards, Dwayne.
He's got a lot of boards. I'm still upset that Dwayne Board didn't have Buda Baker higher on his draft board, but that's okay.
Do you think that Dwayne Board could consider opening a store where he sells poster board?
Dwayne Board's poster board?
Yeah. This could go on for hours if we continue with. Of course, the interesting thing about Chris Richard going to Dallas.
He was sent off to Dwayne Board's boarding school.
Oh, no. Is that Earl Thomas has previously, you'll recall, expressed his interest in playing for the Cowboys.
I do remember that.
That was kind of a thing. So we'll see if Chris Richard helps lure him there.
I know.
Like, if Earl Thomas actually makes it to unrestricted free agency, which he is not currently an unrestricted free agent, which is why this story is somewhat premature.
And how many signings happen because of defensive back coaches?
Oh, most of them.
He's basically defensive backs coach / GM.
I mean, I think it's more from a recruiting element.
Recruiting Earl Thomas coordinator.
I don't think it's convincing the Dallas Cowboys that they should be interested in Earl Thomas. I think that most teams are.
He's recruiting the person who went to the head coach of the Cowboys and said, come and get me, or whatever.
Just strengthens that bond, apparently. I don't know.
It's probably the only reason they hired him.
I don't know what else to tell you.
The Cowboys are desperate for Earl Thomas's twilight years.
All right. Anything else on the Seahawks? Anything else on the roundup? Do we have any grievances this week? Not particularly.
My grievance was with you.
Yeah, you already aired that grievance. All right, let's wrap things up with Husky men's basketball, which now I think has moved into kind of the marquee position when we're talking about Seattle sports at this point, is the most prominent team that is in season currently. So last weekend we talked about a big weekend for the Huskies in the mountain states of the Pac-12 against a couple of teams in similar position in the conference. And we felt the Huskies kind of needed a split to stay on track to potentially make the NCAA tournament. And lo and behold, that's what they got. A 70-62 loss on Thursday at Utah, followed up by an impressive 72-62 win Saturday at Colorado.
I wasn't able to see that one, but what happened in the Colorado? You didn't see it either, did you?
No, I didn't see. I saw like 30 seconds between these two games combined.
Oh,
because
man.
On Thursday night I was at the Blazers game and then Saturday I was at a family function. So I was following both of them closely on Gamecast on my ESPN app, but that was pretty much it.
The Huskies kind of led most of the game though, right?
I mean, they were down big early and I was like, oh man, things are going to get really ugly. And then the 12-0 run to take the lead.
And they never looked back from that point. I mean, I had looked at the score, I think, going into halftime and they were up like 10 or something. And they kind of just maintained that lead the entire game. It was a pretty impressive victory from that standpoint, and a very un-Husky-like victory. Because I said, this is a 10-point lead at halftime against maybe a better team in their house. The Huskies are going to blow this by the 10-minute mark of the second half. And somehow they didn't.
Yeah. Kept waiting for that Colorado run that basically just never came in this game. So the Huskies now up to number 98 in the KenPom rankings, the highest they have been all season.
There we
go. First time they have cracked into
the
double
digits.
Cracked the
top 100.
They have now pulled even with the final ranking of the 2013-14 team, which you may recall fondly from not having any postseason play whatsoever. Finishing that season at 17-15, 9-9 in Pac-12 play.
I, for one, think in this particular scenario that stats are for losers.
Oh, no. So we should talk a little bit about how the Huskies are doing it.
That's what I was going to say. How did they win this game? How are they doing in general?
Well, there's kind of a common denominator for a lot of the Huskies' wins, and actually for the loss at Utah as well, and that's that opponents are missing threes. The Colorado shot 6 of 22, 27% in this game. Utah, the previous game, shot 7 of 27, 26%. And if you look at the games the Huskies have won in conference play, USC shot 15% on threes. Wazoo shot 26% on threes. Cal, the one outlier here, shot 36% on their 14 three-point attempts. And then Colorado, again, 27%. And here's the thing, is teams aren't shooting a lot better even in wins against UW. Overall, the Huskies rank 11th in conference play so far in offensive rating out of 12 Pac-12 teams. That's not good. But they're number one in defensive rating. And it's really fascinating because there's a lot of things they aren't doing well at all defensively. They give you up the highest defensive rebound rate in the conference so far in Pac-12 play. They're giving up the most offensive rebound.
Offensive rebound.
Which is,
they call that defensive rebound rate.
Yeah, you look at your own defensive rebound rate.
Okay.
Which you make sense as for a zone team.
With a zone. Yes.
But it has really kind of, it wasn't that big of an issue, I would say, during non-conference play and has really become an issue during conference play. They are second to last in the Pac-12 in opponent free throw attempts per field goal attempt, which is a little surprising they're fouling quite that much. And then, they're number two in forcing turnovers. That's part of the good. Then the funny thing is they're number one in opponent effective field goal percentage, so opponent shooting from the field, despite being number six right in the middle of the pack in two-point percentage that they're allowing. And the reason for that is because opponents are making 27.4% of their threes. That is the lowest for any major conference team in conference play so far.
Because the Huskies are playing good defense.
It's because that three-point defense that they've brought.
You really think that they have nothing to do with this? Where it would be true in wins and losses for the entire season?
I mean,
you think it's all luck?
First off, it's not been true for the entire season. I mean, that was kind of part of the thing here is that... did I get the wrong one? Now I'm looking at this and it says that... Oh, no, I'm on... I'm looking at this and it says that Florida is allowing 40% three-point shooting in conference play. So maybe I had the wrong team when I was looking at that.
What?
you know what? I did have the wrong team, and there are, in fact, a few teams that are doing this in the SEC. And Kentucky is allowing opponents to shoot 24% on threes because the SEC can't shoot threes. I don't know how I misread that previously. But anyway, that does not change how aberrant the Husky shooting is. The next lowest three-point percentage that anyone is allowing in the Pac-12 is Stanford at 32.1%.
But how can you just say this is luck?
Because if you look at, and Ken Pomeroy has done all this research. So let's say you split the season into two halves. So you look at how teams do in various stats in the first half of the season and the second half of the season. Naturally, you'd expect they do pretty similarly, all things considered. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at that in two-point percentage, even defensively, it's pretty similar first half to second half. Three-point percentage, how well you do in the first half does not really explain at all how well you're going to do in the second half.
You're saying it's all luck.
I'm not saying it's all luck, but what I am saying is that the samples are too small. If there is such a skill as controlling opponent three-point percentage, the samples are too small for that to be seen. Like, by an NBA 82-game season, you can start to see it a little bit. But over the 35 games you play in college, there's a few of them. And even still, it's like you're a couple percent better than league average, really. Not your 8% better than league average. Okay. Which is what the Huskies are doing so far in conference. But no, I have mentioned in the past that there is some track record of Syracuse and other teams using the Syracuse zone being better at defending the three-pointer than league average. But again, we're talking about like 1% to 2% better on average, not 8% better.
The Huskies have been wildly better. So you're saying if you wanted to make regression to the mean work for you, you would bet on everybody else?
Yes.
You would short the Huskies.
And I would have bet on the Huskies going into this year because of the fact that last year in conference play, they allowed opponents to shoot 41.5% on three-pointers, which was the worst mark in the league.
Man, I feel kind of bad for Lorenzo. But
I mean, that's kind of what happens. You often get fired because you're unlucky, and then you get seen as a good coach because of the fact that your team is doing well and getting lucky on things you can't control.
This is the Brian Schottenheimer argument.
It is.
I'm using it against yourself. You just argued your own Brian Schottenheimer argument from a week ago.
I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily the case with the Rams.
Lawyered. Anyway.
I mean, look, I don't actually think that Brian Schottenheimer is an amazing offensive coordinator, turnaround specialist. I just think he's not that terrible.
Do you think there's anything to be said for Matisse Thybulle just being an amazing defender?
So one interesting stat, a follower of mine on Twitter, Will Schrieffer, has been tracking this and mentioned it. Matisse Thybulle has blocked an NCAA high 13 three-pointers this season. Nobody else has blocked even 10 threes because that's...
Blocked 13 threes?
But still, we're talking about not that many shots over the course of the season.
That's a lot of threes to block, though.
It is a lot of threes to block. I mean, Matisse Thybulle's great. Don't get me wrong. I mean, what I will say positively about the Huskies' three-point defense, and particularly for a zone, they've done an incredible job. Because the other half of that Syracuse equation was we noted that generally they tend to allow more three attempts than you would like to as a good defense. The Huskies have done a phenomenal job of cutting down on three-point attempts. They are allowing the second lowest three-point attempt rate so far in conference play. And that is sustainable. That is a very good sign.
So they're not allowing that many threes, and even when teams shoot them, they're not hitting them.
Yes.
Man, Mike Hopkins has perfected this defense.
I mean, if three-point luck is a defense, then yes, Mike Hopkins has perfected it. So it'll be interesting because this defense will be tested again by Washington State in the return match between those two teams this Sunday night at Heck Ed. The Huskies will wrap up the first half of conference play, although they'll actually have only played 8 games at that point out of the 18 because of the fact that they've played both of their matchups against the Cougars and will have nothing but 2-game weekends the rest of the way. Washington State, despite coming into this one 1-6 in conference play, has been outstanding from 3-point range.
Really?
They are shooting 39% on threes in Pac-12 play and have attempted more than half of their shots from 3-point range, the most in the conference.
Why are they not winning more games?
So they're number one in the conference in effective field goal percentage and yet have the 9th best offensive rating because they are terrible at literally everything else but shooting the ball.
Huh.
They are dead last in turnover rate, dead last in free throw attempt rate, and 10th out of 12 teams in offensive rebound rate.
So this is like, I ask you this sometimes when I talk about NBA players and I'm like, why in a league where three-point shooting is all that matters, why is Kyle Korver not a superstar or somebody like that? Why are there players who can just shoot threes but they aren't good? And Wazoo is the answer to that question.
Yes. Wazoo is like a whole team of Troy Daniels. What if they made the whole team out of Troy Daniels? We did mention after
Do you want me to try to guess what team Troy Daniels is?
Who he played for?
Memphis?
He was on Memphis last year, but he is no longer on the Memphis Grizzlies.
What team is he on?
He was traded to the Phoenix Suns. The Phoenix Suns this year. We mentioned after the Huskies played the Cougars in Pullman a few weeks ago, I really liked the approach they had offensively. It didn't translate into a win, but they did a nice job of finding Robert Franks, who's their 6'7 stretch four in the high post. That was a lot of long twos that Robert Franks, who's making 43% of his threes this season, was getting. And that's, again, one of the nice things about the zone and its weaknesses. But he was also finding guys out of the high post. They got a lot of offensive rebounds, but the Huskies eventually were able to get enough stops to win that game. So we will see if they can do that again this week.
I mean, that was a game. This is not going to be in Pullman. It probably will look very different. But that was a game that Wazoo probably should have won.
Yes. It was a no-L for the Huskies. We debated it, but ultimately, I think you had the stronger argument that it was, in fact, a no-L.
Did I say that they didn't have an L, therefore it was a no-L?
You did, and noted that Jalen Noel made the go-ahead basket. It was a compelling case.
I stand by all of it.
I'm very curious to see the turnout for this one on a Sunday night. There's no NFL. It's the week off between the conference championships and the Super Bowl. Or the Pro Bowl. People are staying home to watch Russell Wilson in the Pro Bowl.
Just terrified, God. If there's anything that's even worse than preseason football, it's the Pro Bowl.
Set your DVRs for that one if you want to watch Russell Wilson. Come out to the game, because the Huskies, I'm hoping that people are going to be excited from the momentum of the Huskies beating Colorado last week and turn out for this one. The start of a three-game homestand that will also include visits from Arizona State and Arizona the following weekend. Those ones, I think, probably particularly the Arizona game, will be well attended. And, you know, I think you would expect that the basketball Apple Cup will be as well.
I'm excited. This is happening. I mean, that win in Colorado, if you want to talk about really quickly where the Huskies are at, kind of within the Pac-12, you talked about how there's kind of this clump of teams and somebody is going to emerge from that.
Which there still is, by the way. There's now... Stanford has broken out of this clump. I don't think they were last week. They're now projected to go 10-8. Now the four teams projected to go, or the five teams projected to, no, it was four, projected to go 9-9 in Pac-12 and tied for fifth at this point. UCLA, Utah, despite beating UW last week, Oregon and UW all projected to go 9-9 in conference play by KenPom.com.
Which would put them fringe NCAA tournament team.
I mean, I think they probably want to go 10-8 to, you know, maximize their chances. They're also sitting, this was before Monday night's games, but last time I looked, they were at number 51 in the RPI rankings. Mm-mm. So again, it looks like they've moved up. They have moved up with the handful of games that were played on Monday night. They are now back in the top 50 at
number
50.
There we go. Back NCAA on the NCAA championship. Here we come.
Back on the first page.
Top 50, baby.
ESPN's RPI rankings.
Well, I'm looking forward to this game, and it will be a huge game.
Yeah, should we do chances of victory?
What does Ken Pom say?
I think 77%.
I think it's a little bit more than that.
You always think it's a little bit more than that.
I think they have about an 80% chance of winning.
I'm sorry, 73. I misspoke.
They went into Wazoo, had a very strong victory there. This one coming back, there should be some momentum.
Oh yeah, that's definitely a real thing when you have...
No. I meant there should be some energy at the arena.
Yes.
Yeah, there should be some momentum with the week off in between.
The 8 days for the layoff.
But there should be some energy at the stadium. I think that they could probably get behind this one. You know, it's not like they're playing a good team. I think Stanford, that loss that they had previously, is just a pretty solid team.
Stanford has been playing well lately. They followed up by splitting against the Arizona schools. They beat Arizona State and then lost by two at home to Arizona. Now 5-2 in conference play.
So I don't really consider that a bad loss at this point.
Yeah, I don't think it was a bad loss even then. It was just a disappointing loss because it was, you know, the kind of game that certainly the Huskies could have won and had a lot of excitement about where they were as a program.
So hopefully they win this one and it'll carry them into the week with the Arizona schools, with the fan base kind of a little bit riled up, students paying attention.
I mean, I think the students are in. I think it's really about kind of the general city at large
now.
It's
me.
I don't know about you specifically.
We're both wearing Husky clothes right now. That's how in we are.
I mean, you need to like actually attend a game at some point, but you've been avidly following from home.
That's what I'm saying, is I need to be there.
Yeah, I guess it is. Yeah, it's you. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to be there. So I'm not the question mark. I'm not going to be cheering, though, because I will be there as a member of the media.
Because I would never.
I mean, I'm just there as a member of the media.
Even when you're not with the media, you seem like you're always there as a member of the media. Anyway, what
at Husky football games, I seem like there as a member of the media.
You seem like at Husky football games, like you're there as a fan of the other team.
No, come on.
Katie's going to love all these takes. These are just for Katie. What was your percentage chance of victory?
I'm going to go 75% chance of victory this weekend.
Okay.
All right. Well, that should be a fun one to watch. And on that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.